Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Tonight I'd like to talk about moving the practice from listening to talks about it, reading books about it, to doing it. And I'd like to start with a story from India. And this is a story about a teacher who had a centre where people would come every evening to participate in a puja. And the teacher had a cat, and the cat was usually wherever the teacher was. But on a couple of occasions, the cat played up during the puja. And so the teacher realized that the only thing to do was to put the cat outside. So every evening, just before the puja started, he would take his cat and put the cat outside, and then he would conduct the puja, and everything went along well. This went on for a few years, and then the teacher died. So the disciples would come every evening to the centre, and they would put the cat outside, and then they would conduct the puja. And things went along nicely for a couple of years more, and then the cat died. So the first thing that the disciples did was to go down to the village to get a new cat, because putting the cat out had become part of the puja, and they thought unless they had the cat there, they couldn't conduct the ceremony. Now this is an example of empty rites and rituals and blindly doing what one sees the teacher doing. And in Buddhism, this is one of the traps that we can fall into, whether it's doing a puja of offering flowers and incense and candles, or just doing our meditation practice because someone told us that it'll be good for us, and this is the way you should practice. And so we're doing it just blindly following on what we've been told. And the Buddha spoke very often about not having this blind faith and not indulging in empty rites and rituals, not doing things just because you've been told to do them, and not believing things just because you've heard the teacher say it. And there's a very well-known teaching which the Buddha gave called the teaching to the Kalamas. And in this particular teaching, it's about not following blindly what teachers tell us to do. And this teaching came about because the Buddha went to a particular town, and the people from that town had heard that he had a very good reputation as a teacher, and so they went to listen to what he had to say. Many other teachers had passed through this town previously, and so the people were always interested to see what this new person had to say. And they liked what they heard the Buddha say, and so they asked him questions. And they said, many teachers come here and tell us what they believe and what they say is the teaching, and then very often they'll disparage what other people have said. They'll say that this teacher's not telling the truth, and you should follow my way. And it makes us very confused, so what should we do? And the Buddha said it's right to have this confusion and this doubt when you hear so many different teachings. So the thing to do is not to accept that something is true and good for you just because the teacher says it, just because you've heard it many times, just because it's written in the scriptures, or because it's the tradition that you follow, or because you agree with it. It's something that is in accordance with what you've already worked out yourself. The Buddha said that what you should do is examine it, put it into practice, and find out for yourself whether it is helpful or not, whether it leads to your happiness or to your suffering. And only then are you really in the position to know whether this is something that you should follow. And so in this teaching, we have a very clear permission to ask questions, of the teacher, to do something and try it out and see how it is when we actually do it, and then come and talk to friends who are practicing, to keep an open mind about things until we experience them for ourselves. But one of the traps that we can fall into, because we have this understanding that we don't have to believe anything just because we've been told it, is that we interpret that to mean I don't have to do anything that I've been told if I don't like it, if I don't agree with it. And so we fall into the trap of picking and choosing those bits of the teaching which we're going to take up for practice. And before we've even put them into practice, before we've even investigated for ourselves, we've decided that this is wrong, or this doesn't suit me, or I'm not ready for this, or we think we know what the results of practicing that will be before we've practiced it, and we might say, I don't need that, I'm past that. And so we can decide, not based on experience, but based on our own views and opinions, what the path is for me. So although the Buddha said that we should ask questions and not just believe things because that's what the teacher said, in another teaching he gave a very clear teaching that we shouldn't make that kind of assumption before we have investigated and found out from our own experience. And this particular teaching is the one that I'd like to elaborate on tonight. How do we move from hearing the teaching and taking up those parts of the path which we may not find attractive to start with? And the particular teaching that the Buddha gave was on account of giving some instructions to some monks, and they decided that they knew better than the Buddha. And this was at a time when the Buddha had just established the rule that monks and nuns should only eat in the forenoon, before noon each day, and that they shouldn't eat in the evening. And the Buddha said that from his experience he realized that you could live quite healthily and happily by just eating before midday. And so for various other reasons, because it was more convenient for lay people, because it meant that monks and nuns didn't have to be out wandering around the village at any time of day or night looking for food, he made the rule that monks and nuns should only eat before noon. And most of the monks followed that rule, but there were some monks who heard the rule and they said, well, we live very happily eating in the morning and eating at lunchtime and eating in the evening. I don't see why we should follow this rule when we're doing quite well not following it. And so they decided that they would keep to eating at any time of the day. And so some other monks went to speak to them and say, you know, the Lord has made this new rule that we should only eat in the first part of the day, and everyone else is sticking with it. And again, the monks said, well, we're doing quite well eating at any time of the day, so we will stick to this, our way of doing it. It's going to be quite uncomfortable if we only eat in the first part of the day. And so the monks who were following the Buddha's instructions went back to the Buddha and told him that we've passed on this message to these monks, but they've still refused to toe the line. And so the Buddha said, well, you'd better ask them to come and speak to me directly. And so that's what happened. So these monks came to speak directly to the Buddha. And it's around this kind of situation that this teaching arose. And in this teaching, the Buddha said that those disciples who have faith, those who already have some experience of the accuracy and truth of the Buddha's teaching, they're the ones who, when they hear something that I say, what the Buddha says, they really listen with their whole attention, based on the understanding that in the past, whatever the Buddha said has been the truth. And even if there isn't an understanding immediately of why this is a good thing or how it's going to affect us when we put it into practice, because of that faith and confidence based on our previous experience of the teaching, then when a disciple with faith hears some instructions, it can be assumed that they're going to be willing to take up those instructions based, the Buddha said, on reflective acceptance. Now, this reflective acceptance isn't knowing this thing to be true for ourselves, but thinking around it. Where does this come from? It comes from the Enlightened One. It comes from the Buddha, who's given us very clear and very accurate instructions, whose instructions are based on his own wisdom, on truth, on knowing, not just taking something out of the blue, not just to give us a hard time. So that reflective acceptance understands that if this is part of the blueprint for enlightenment handed down by the Buddha, then it's worth giving it a try, even if it doesn't appeal. And in this particular case, when he was talking to these bhikkhus, he said this to them. He said, have I ever given you any instructions that weren't directly related to liberation, that weren't directly related to cultivating the path to enlightenment? And they had to admit, no, all of the instructions that have been given to us have been part of the total package. Nothing is there that's extraneous, that's not really significant, that's not part of what we're trying to accomplish. And the Buddha said, when I have given you this particular instruction to eat only before noon, it's not because I want you to have a difficult time. And it's not because I don't realise that it isn't always comfortable not to eat in the evening. But because I see the benefit of this particular practice, not just for one's comfort and pleasure, but for the cultivation of the path to enlightenment. And so he said to these bhikkhus, when you are hungry and there's an unpleasant feeling in the stomach, there is discomfort. But part of this path is learning to bear with discomfort and not allowing the mind to be upset by what is going on in the body. And certainly, if when you're hungry you eat, a feeling of pleasure will arise. You will have overcome temporarily that discomfort that was there. But that won't be the last time that you ever have to eat. You won't have overcome your unhappiness with having an empty stomach. You won't be full forever. You'll have to face again dealing with an empty stomach, not getting what you want. And what kind of strength of mind will you have to bring to bear on that? If each time you experience that, you simply give in. So renouncing food and challenging that desire in the mind to be comfortable by eating, this is an opportunity to strengthen the mind in letting go. And if you do that, understanding the purpose of what you're trying to accomplish, freeing yourself of dependence on just having things comfortable, then what will arise in place of that unpleasant feeling from the empty stomach is a pleasant feeling based on your spiritual practice. And it's making these pleasant feelings that are unworldly, that are spiritual, making those grow in our mind, in our heart, that is the spiritual path. So if we're able to give up something that is relatively easy and endure, and then experience that joy at renunciation, that helps us to cultivate the strength of mind necessary to give up next time in other circumstances. So, for example, when we're sitting in meditation and we're trying to watch the breath and the mind starts to settle and then we get an ache in our knee. And if we haven't practiced bearing with unpleasant feeling, and if we feel we always have to settle the body again to be comfortable so then we can meditate, we will always stay at the point where we're driven by the unpleasant feelings to move away from the meditation object. And we will never be able to settle continuously on the meditation object and experience the peace that is possible. So if we practice renouncing the urge to comfort in the meditation, and we get more and more skillful at doing that and more strength of mind to do that, then we will find eventually we will be able to turn away from the body and just stay with the breath and experience those peaceful states that do arise. And this is the path of practice. So the Buddha was pointing out to these bhikkhus that being able to turn away from comfort, seeking comfort, is the way to start to develop those pleasant feelings which arise directly from our spiritual development, from an internal source. If we are always looking for an external source for our happiness, for our contentment, for our comfort, then that's where we're always going to have to rely. So in this particular teaching, when he spoke to the bhikkhus in this way and explained what was the basis of giving this rule, then they could see that there was a reason for it that was part of their spiritual growth. And so they conceded that even though they hadn't understood in the beginning, now they could see the point and they would follow the instructions. But the Buddha was making the point for all of us that anything that he's given as a part of this path is based on his enlightened wisdom, And so it's not up to us to decide whether we think it's really necessary or whether it's an important thing to do, to pick and choose, until we have tried it out for ourselves. So the reflective acceptance that allows us to take up the practice is based on understanding that this teaching is a whole package. And we can't presume to know what the end result is going to be of taking up a particular practice until we take it up and do it. So after this reflective acceptance, then the Buddha said, if one really sees that this is part of the path, then enthusiasm, zeal, arises in the mind to give it a go, to try it out and find out for ourselves. But very often when we have this enthusiasm to put something into place in our practice, we see that it's contrary to our habits, to what we like to do, what we find comfortable. And so we have to use an act of will in order to do it. It doesn't come easily, it doesn't come naturally, but so we have to generate this determination that we're going to try it out, we're going to do it. So we might be told that it would be good if we could meditate every day without letting one day go by without sitting down for at least 20 minutes. And we've heard this so many times, and we still haven't managed to fit daily meditation practice into our routine. We'd like to, but you know, how can we? We're too busy, we've got too much going on, there's no time. So with reflective acceptance, we realize, yeah, this is what they've been saying, this is what the Buddha advocated. Maybe it's time that I gave it a try. Now, I want to do it, but how can I do it? So we have to make a determination using our willpower to get up early in the morning or find some time in the afternoon instead of sitting in front of the television, or taking some time in the evening to remove ourselves from everything else that's happening in the house and give ourselves some quiet time away from everyone else. So this act of will has to operate in order to make that practice happen. So first there's the reflective acceptance, then there's the enthusiasm to do it based on faith, and then there is the act of will to put it into practice. And then as we do that, we investigate. And we recognize that if we're doing something which takes a lot of effort, then we're not going to see the results immediately. If we're changing the way we've always done things, if we're trying to establish a meditation practice that hasn't been there before, then we can't expect to get results overnight. So then we make a determination to continue with this practice for a specific period of time, whether we like it or not, whether it seems to be working or not, whether it feels comfortable or not. We don't do it once or twice and say, oh, I knew I was right, the Buddha was wrong, this isn't any good for me, and we give it up. No, we have to be prepared to stick with it. And as we're sticking with it, to keep our eyes open to the reactions that arise in the mind. Trying to bargain, or maybe I don't need to meditate for 20 minutes, I don't need to get up half an hour earlier in the morning, I could just get up 10 minutes earlier and do 5 minutes of meditation. I'd be doing it every day and then I'd still get another 20 minutes in bed in the morning. We bargain around all of these things. well, I was going to keep 8 precepts once a month, but I mean, once every 6 months is pretty good going, because spending the whole day at the temple is, you know, it's a bit boring, it's a bit tiring. And so we find that instead of doing what we've committed ourselves to, we try and slip out of it. So we have to be very firm. That's where this act of will has to come in, because our habit patterns towards comfort and ease and to what we can do without too much difficulty will push against our determination to really give this practice a go. And as we investigate, we keep our eyes open to the ways we do try to avoid what needs to be done and the excuses that come up, because we're learning about our own mind. We're learning about ourself. And the Buddha said, if you learn about yourself, you'll know what other people's minds are like too. So we're not only learning about ourselves, we're learning about everyone. And we're learning how hard it is to do something that goes against the grain. And then as we investigate, as we keep our eyes open, as we persist with the practice that we've taken up, only then are we in the position to make a judgment about the effect that this has. Whether this is really good for me, whether the Buddha was right. So we're moving from blind faith, just agreeing or just doing it because someone said. We're also avoiding the trap of deciding what we think is right or wrong without even trying it out. But in order to really persist, to really integrate this new practice into our daily routine, very often we need to have some external supports. And the Buddha said there are two supports that are very important for being able to establish something new in our practice. And one of them is external, and that is having good friends on the path. And good friends on the path are people who are valuing what it is that you're trying to do. People who are trying to do it themselves. People who have experienced the same kinds of resistances to doing practice. The same kinds of difficulties that we're experiencing. And so we need to make sure that we give ourselves the opportunity to come in contact with people who understand what we're about and who value what we're about and who can give us some help to stick with it and achieve what it is that we've set ourselves to achieve. So it doesn't have to be monks and nuns, but it has to be people who are well practiced, people who are able to guide you because they have been there and done that themselves. And that's why it's so important to make the effort to come to a place like this, to come to hear the teaching, and to be in the company of fellow practitioners. Not only are people who come here trying to practice meditation, but they're also trying to keep the 5 precepts. And keeping the 5 precepts, living a moral life, a life of integrity, that's also something that's not so easy to do. It's not encouraged in the world generally, but it's essential for progress on the spiritual path. So if we are hanging out with people who don't keep the 5 precepts or who don't think it's important to keep the 5 precepts, then it's easy for us to think, no, well, we can do our spiritual stuff when we go to the temple, but in the rest of my life, it doesn't matter how I live, what I do. We will undermine our own possibility of success, of being able to grow in the path. So we need to make sure that the people that we're associating with not only are meditating, but are also keeping the 5 precepts and supporting the good life, the life of wholesomeness, that is an essential support for the spiritual path. The other thing that the Buddha said is essential for our growth is not only the external condition of good friends, but an internal attitude of mind, which is called wise attention. And this wise attention, yoniso manasikara in Pali, you'll come across very often when you're reading the scriptures. And wise attention is about keeping our eyes open to what's happening in our own experience and reflecting on it in terms of the Dharma. Reflecting on it in the light of the teaching that we've heard, in the light of the training that we're trying to follow. So instead of just looking at the practice that we're doing and thinking, this is too hard for me, or this doesn't suit me, or I don't like this. In terms of the Dharma, we reflect that everything arises according to causes and conditions. And if we want to institute something that's new in our life, then we have to provide the necessary supportive conditions. And whatever sort of practice we're trying to do, then we need to find out what the supporting conditions are and see whether they're present in our life. So, for example, one of the supporting conditions is good friends. Another is hearing the Dharma. Another is having confidence in the teaching. So we can see if we think that something isn't right for us or if it doesn't seem to be true. Have I got those factors in my life? And if I don't have those factors, then it's only to be expected that this particular practice won't seem as though it suits me, or it'll be more difficult to cultivate. So as well as just addressing the particular practice that we're trying to do, we go and see about developing, cultivating those supporting conditions. So if we think, for example, about loving kindness practice, we hear all the time, loving kindness practice is really good for you. Everyone needs to cultivate loving kindness practice. And very often people will say, oh, I've tried it, it doesn't work. Oh, it's too hard. I don't find it nice at all. I can't get any kind of pleasant feeling when I do loving kindness. I hate loving kindness practice. It's an accurate experience for many people. And if we feel that we hate loving kindness practice, then that's a very good indication that that's exactly the kind of practice that we need to do. But if we think in the worldly way, anything I hate, then I should avoid. Why should I suffer more? Especially if I'm trying to cultivate the path. So then we need to go and talk to someone who can give us some guidance and explain what's happening in the mind as it revolts against doing loving kindness practice. And what's a skillful way of starting to approach loving kindness practice? There are many different ways of approaching that kind of practice. And if we're finding it difficult, what can I learn about myself in those difficulties? Rather than just saying, oh, if it's hard, I shouldn't be doing it. What's it showing me? What's it telling me? What can I learn about the way that I relate to myself or relate to other people? So this is reflecting in the light of the Dharma, using wise attention, rather than just our worldly way of looking at things and our worldly way of judging. So the Buddha said, with wise attention, we are able to learn from even the things that we don't like, even from the things that we find difficult to do. And particularly if we are trying to institute a new thing in our practice, it's likely that we're going to encounter difficulties, and then we're going to encounter resistance. So rather than saying that means it's wrong for me, we say, what can I learn from it? And what else do I need to incorporate in order to make this thing come to life for me, in order to be successful in doing it? So going back to the starting point of this talk, the Buddhist path isn't about just doing things blindly and believing it because the teacher said, but we should also be cautious about falling into the trap of saying that because I don't have to believe it means I don't have to try it out. Don't have to do it if I don't like it, if it doesn't appeal to me. We can only say that we really know whether something is true and whether it's suitable for us, whether it's helpful for us, after we've tried it out. And so particularly if we've already grown through the teachings that we've heard and through the way we've used them in our life, then that confidence that this is the right path, that the Buddha was enlightened, that the instructions that he's given are relevant, are accurate, are part of our own progress towards the end of suffering, that faith and confidence should allow us to take things up, to accept them just as a hypothesis, so we can investigate. And as we investigate, we should also support that investigation with good friends, going back to the teaching, going back to the teachers to get clarification, and then internally investigate our experience to see what we can learn from what we're doing. Because very often what we will learn will surprise us. It won't be what we expected to find. It won't be what we assumed would be our experience as we did the practice. So I encourage all of you to reflect on this teaching and to try to apply it, and particularly in this beginning of the new year, to ask yourselves, what can I do in this year to give some new life and energy to my practice? What's something that I've been putting off doing for the last few years since I've been listening to the teaching? What is it that I could make a determination to start right now in this first month of the year, so that I can carry it through, and at the end of this year, when I look back and see what I've accomplished in the last 12 months, there'll be something in my spiritual practice, in my spiritual growth, that I can really rejoice in. So may this teaching be of benefit to all of you, and may the merit of this teaching help us all to attain Nibbana. If anyone has any questions or comments, I'd be happy to try to answer them. Right. The question is that if you're quieting the mind with a particular meditation object and you find that that's working, is it necessary to change to something that you find difficult, like loving kindness? I think we have to understand that the purpose of doing loving kindness meditation is not just to quieten the mind. It is to develop feelings of loving kindness, of goodwill, of compassion, generally, not just to have it in the meditation itself. So even if we're experiencing peaceful states through a meditation object other than loving kindness, it's always useful to incorporate some loving kindness practice into our meditation, because particularly if the mind is quite peaceful and then we start to do loving kindness meditation and the mind is no longer peaceful because we're doing something that's difficult, that's an opportunity for insight to arise. We use the peaceful mind that we've developed through some other object to allow us to see more clearly why is it that loving kindness practice is so difficult? Why is it that when I move on to that particular topic that the mind becomes disturbed? And so if there's disturbance, if there's resistance, then there's a work to be done in the area of loving kindness. So one of the skillful means for developing loving kindness is to use a meditation object that is already working as the recipient, the object of your loving kindness. So if, for example, the breath is the meditation object, you have loving kindness towards the breath. And that is an object which is much more neutral than a person. And you can start to build up some momentum of loving kindness on that particular object. And then after you've developed that loving kindness momentum, then you switch to some other object which isn't so easy to use. And because the mind is quite peaceful, you'll be able to notice what resistance is arising and where that's coming from. So it's loving kindness practice is very useful for seeing more clearly the dark spots in our mind or in our heart. Yes. Right. Are you the question is it's important to have supportive conditions and friends who are valuing what you're doing, but what if you're spending most of your day in the company of people who are don't value what you're doing and who are living a different kind of lifestyle? Is that, are you meaning that they're not keeping the five precepts?
No.
Right. So the question is that they're behaving in unskillful ways. So you don't use those, or you don't depend on that group of people for your support. That's why you have to actively seek out people who are cultivating the qualities that you aspire to for yourself. So if you're spending your most of your time with people in a work environment, for example, who are not doing that, then you have to actively seek out people who are supportive and who do understand what you're doing. And for many people, many of us have no choice over the kind of people that we're spending a lot of our time with in work. So you have to understand the impact of those kinds of associations day after day after day, the impact they do have on the mind. And particularly until we're very established in our own inner strength and inner confidence, we can be swayed by the contacts that we have day after day after day. So it's very important to deliberately expose yourself to counterbalancing influences when you're being exposed to negative influences day in, day out. And then the other thing to also reflect on is maybe I should think about trying to change my work environment, particularly if I can see that these kinds of daily contacts are not beneficial for my own well-being. So as you develop more inner strength and inner stability, inner confidence, then you will be able to engage with people like that with more loving kindness, more compassion and more equanimity. So you won't be so affected by those contacts. But in order to get to that point, you have to develop your own inner buoyancy and inner stability, not rely on those people to make you feel good.